This program is brought to you by Pussy Magnets. Putting men down in friends with a
Pussy Magnet. Welcome, welcome, my lovely lumps. Or should I say lovely labs? I'm so thrilled to have you here in the Labia Lounge. We're going to yarn about all things sexuality, womanhood, relationships, intimacy, holistic health, and everything in between. Your legs. Ooh. Can't help myself. Anyway, we're going to have vag loads of real chats with real people about real shit. So buckle up. You're about to receive the sex ed that you never had and have a bloody good laugh while you're at it. Before we dive in, I'd like to respectfully acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which I'm recording this, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. It's an absolute privilege to be living and creating dope podcast content in Naam, and I pay respect to their elders past, present, and emerging. Now, if y'all are ready, let's flap and do this. Oh my God, is there such thing as too many vagina jokes in the one intro? Whatever, it's my podcast. I'm leaving it in.
Don't panic, you're not broken. Your sex education was a piece of shit. Get your flaps out and pull the couch. It's the Labia Lounge.
Hey, Labia Legends. So stoked to have you back for another interview on the Labia Lounge, because this week I have an incredibly intelligent, articulate, and fascinating guest to present to you, Ruby Warrington. I'm a little bit starstruck, actually. I've been reading your book. I've heard you on podcasts. So I'm really thrilled to be chatting with you today, Ruby. Welcome.
Thanks, Freya. It's great to be here.
So to give everyone a rundown on this darling guest of mine, Ruby Warrington is a British-born author, editor, and publishing consultant, recognized as having the unique ability to identify issues that are destined to become part of the cultural narrative. She's perhaps best known as the creator of the term sober curious. Her 2008 book and million download podcast of the same title, having helped to spearhead a global movement to reevaluate our relationship with alcohol. Oh my God, might have to do another episode on that. Ruby's other works include Material Girl, Mystical World, The Sober Curious Reset, and Women Without Kids, The Revolutionary Rise of the Unsung Sisterhood. And her work has been featured by countless media outlets globally, including The New York Times, The Guardian, and Good Morning America. She lives in Brooklyn. And the focus of this conversation today is going to be all about the decision so many women are now facing as to whether or not to have kids, since it's becoming increasingly common to opt out of this once default life path. And there are so many more women questioning this default expectation of them in ways that we never had the luxury of questioning before, nor as much of a need to question before, I would argue. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure I'll share a little bit about where I sit with all of this as a 33-year-old woman without children yet, but I'd love to give the listeners some context as to what sparked you to write a book called Women Without Kids, Ruby.
Well, thanks for that lovely intro. Yeah, you put it really well, I think. And I write about this in the book. The decision about whether or not to become a mother is a relatively new phenomenon among the mainstream, right? Like for the majority of women, there wasn't necessarily the option to go a different path, to choose whether or not you wanted to have children, to choose how many children you wanted to have. There has always been, you know, there have always been methods of birth control that people have had access to. Women have, to an extent, always had some capacity to kind of work with their cycle, to work with various herbs, etc., to kind of like control their fertility. But reliable and accessible birth control only really became available in the middle of the last century. So it's only really
and not being burned for being a witch.
Right. Exactly. And then adding into that, of course, safe and legal abortion. As a backstop, like this is a relatively new development in terms of the history of womankind. And so this is a new phenomenon. Now, I'm somebody who knew from a very young age that motherhood wasn't necessarily for me. I'll put it like that for now. It obviously wasn't that cut and dried when I was 5 years old, but let's just say as a kid, I never played with toy baby dolls. I never fantasized about being a mother. I never pictured that for myself. And it was only as I kind of reached my mid-20s, I suppose, that I began to be aware of how truly, well, I'd say revolutionary now, but how truly unusual that stance seemed to be. It was still very much, you know, when I was in my 20s, still very much the default was that you would, your ultimate goals as a woman were to find a husband, get married, and have children. Like whatever else you might want to do with your life, that was, those were the kind of like big overarching life choices that would validate you as a woman. And so not necessarily wanting to have children immediately placed me very much in the out group. And it was something, therefore, that I questioned very, very deeply throughout my 20s and my 30s, even though throughout that questioning period, there was always this very strong inner knowing that that wasn't the right path for me. But so many times I almost talked myself into it. Almost taught myself into wanting to be a mother. And then kind of concurrent to that was deep shame, deep self-doubt around whether the fact that I didn't want to be a mother meant that there was something really fundamentally wrong with me, you know, maybe even on a biological level. And it was only really, I mean, one of the ways that it ties to my work with Sober Curious is that it was only really removing alcohol from my life and just getting so much more clarity about who I am as a human being, what I really want for myself, what lights me up, what doesn't, that I was able to connect more deeply to that inner knowing I'd had around not wanting to be a mother. And that was kind of like, you know, I was in my early 40s by that point and honestly starting to look ahead to menopause and what that might bring for me. And I realized that I was actually quite excited about the transition of menopause, which again is a very outsiderist position. Most people are taught to dread it, right? But I was sort of like, wow, this is going to be really interesting. And nowhere in my contemplation of the transition of menopause did I feel any sort of panic in my body around having missed out on this thing, having not done this very important thing I was supposed to do, become a mother. And within that, I realized, wow, all of that doubt, all of that shame, all of that questioning was because of the external projections that are placed on women about what it means to be a mother and what it means not to be a mother. And within that, I thought, wow, there's a really juicy subject here to dive into, because then, of course, I kind of zoomed out and with my journalist's hat on, very quickly saw that, yes, this is the choice that more and more women are making. The birth rate, meaning the number of women, children that women are having individually, is declining very steeply. All in every single country in the world, the birth rate is going down. And so this huge demographic shift that we're seeing is actually reflective of millions and millions and millions of deeply personal, often very conflicted decisions in this area. And I thought, well, can I produce a book that offers some guidance, some validation, some food for thought for people who are in that decision-making process, for people who've maybe made the decision to have children and are still feeling conflicted around that, for people who haven't been able to have children and are feeling all of the shame and the judgment that comes with that. So yeah, it just felt like such a rich, juicy subject, and one that obviously I had a real strong personal connection to. So yeah, that's kind of why Women Without Kids. And one thing I really wanted to do was to try to speak to women who can't have kids and women who don't want to have kids, and everyone on wherever they fall on that kind of what I call a motherhood spectrum, because it's not always as simple or as black and white as can't have kids, don't want kids. It's often a very kind of messy, circuitous, like up and down path. And I wanted to acknowledge that as well.
Yeah, beautiful. Such a community service that you've done by writing a book like this, because I'm sure, so many people have felt that external you know, cultural, societal pressure and rising hysteria the closer they get to that childbearing age. Well, not the closer they get to childbearing age, the closer they get to leaving childbearing age. You know, I'm smack bang at that point where it does start to kind of get louder, you know, mm-hmm. and it's not my panic that I'm feeling. It's other people's panic and kind of rising like urgency. But it's so easy to be gaslit into thinking it's your own, you know, desire or like, urgency to have kids. And oh my gosh, what if, you know, the thing that I absolutely can't stand, but I used to be guilty of thinking this and maybe even saying this to one or two people is like, oh my God, but what if you regret not having kids? What if you miss the boat and then you regret it later, you know? And so, it's so, because that's so insidious and it's so common and so accepted to fucking chuck your 2 cents in and say something like that to somebody, you know, who you have no idea like what has gone into their decision making or whether, you know, I mean, it's such a personal and nuanced decision and arguably the biggest of someone's life. Mm-hmm. It's wild that we kind of feel like we have this license to make a comment on that or get them to question that. And to question their decision so, yeah, rudely. I think it's so important and valuable that, you know, there are more and more resources like this and conversations like this, you know, to help that minority of women who don't have kids, can't have kids, don't want to have kids, all the different reasons, you know, to feel normal and feel validated because, yeah, like you said, it's pretty much the be all and end all of like womanhood, or it has been marketed to us as that. And everything, you know, leading up to adulthood is around like when you are, you know, womanhood and motherhood are like interchangeable terms practically. Like, so yeah, I think it's great that this really massive and really personal decision is starting to be something that we're reclaiming. And it's more normalized as well, because I feel like there's so much judgment and shame that gets heaped on women if they don't want to become a mum. And like, yeah, something that I was keen to kind of highlight. I either read it in your book or heard it in the podcast, but it was something around like the kinds of categories of people without kids, or the reasons why someone might not become a mother. Cause I think what people assume and what I kind of assumed, was that if you don't have kids, it's because you can't, because of infertility, or something. But actually the like most common reason for women to be without children is because of circumstances. Or like, can you give us a bit of a rundown on some of the reasons and categories of like, quote unquote, childless women?
Yeah, sure. So I'll go into that in a sec, but there's something I just wanted to kind of like pick up on from what you were saying, which is, well, first of all, yes, this is one area of life, like drinking, actually, this is another crossover between these two books, but like, this is an area of life that other people feel very validated in having a lot of opinions about. And it's an incredibly, if not the most personal decision that a person can make. Like, am I going to make birth another human being? Like, am I going to use my body for this very, very specific, very personal and intimate thing? And yet, yes, because we have, I think it just shines a light on how high of an expectation there has been for women to become mothers.
Yeah.
That people feel like they have the right to kind of like say, to have all these judgments about it, to have all these opinions about it, right? And that thing you said about like whether or not we will regret it. I mean, that really speaks to, and I think it's very natural to ask ourselves that question, will I regret not doing this thing? Because it is. It's like honestly one of the only decisions that we cannot unmake. It is the biggest decision a person can make in their life, right? And so to question whether or not we'll regret not making that decision is very natural and very normal, but it doesn't mean that we should make that we should do it, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's very interesting. I've heard far more people in my research on this subject talk about regretting having had kids than I have heard talk about regretting not having had kids, right? Totally. I think it's actually, you're actually in a weird way more likely to regret something that you do that doesn't turn out the way you were hoping than you are to regret something that you don't do from a self-protective position. And a lot of the time, to get into the circumstances piece, a lot of the time when people are making a decision not to have children, it is out of self-protection. It's around protecting something, their autonomy, perhaps, their financial stability, their relationship, maybe their relationship to themselves. They're protecting something that they feel may well be compromised by becoming a parent. And that is very, very valid reason not to have children, right? If you're worried about maybe you're going to regret this in the future, I mean, really, truly think about what you will regret not doing or not having now if you make this decision, you know, and think about other ways that you might be able to parent, other ways that you might be able to have children, be involved in children's lives that could sort of fulfill that for you. Now, obviously, having your own children is, it brings with it huge life experiences that you can't necessarily replicate in other ways. And these are really important things to weigh. And I think the earlier we can start entering into that decision-making process, the better. But the fact is, because we've seen it as just this sort of like default, this thing that will happen, we don't question, we don't encourage people to really apply critical thinking and decision-making to this area of life. I've met so many women who are in their early 40s who are sort of wondering, well, why didn't that happen? Why, I thought it would just happen. But perhaps if they'd have been thinking from their early 20s or even from their teens, even when from when sex ed first kind of like comes into the picture, is this something I want for myself? Perhaps they would have made a decision, yes, it really is, earlier, when they had longer to play with in terms of their fertile window. So I think what I'm really hoping we can do is sort of normalize the questioning, the decision-making process around this as something that people can begin to engage with very early in their lives as they're making those big decisions. Where do I want to live? What kind of a career do I want to have? What kind of a partnership do I want to have? Really thinking about that stuff very early, right? So if you, like I said, if you reach the place of like, this is something I really want, ideally you'll reach it when you're 28, not when you're 38. That would be great, right? So, as which is to say, I'm not telling anybody, hey, don't have kids. I'm saying if you don't want to, that's okay. Absolutely okay. And let's normalize asking the question, do I want this for myself? Which gets into, I think, you know, talking about the childless by choice, childless by circumstance. So the only kind of statistical information on this is pretty outdated these days. It was from like 2014, 2015. And that those statistics show that of all the people who are without children, about 10% are childless due to infertility, meaning they tried to have children and couldn't. About 10% are, you know, what would traditionally or classically be called childless by choice. They always knew this was something that they didn't want. And I would pretty much put myself in that category. And then the other 80% are what's called childless by circumstance. Possibly or probably would have had children under different circumstances, meaning had they met somebody they wanted to co-parent with, had they reached a different point in their career by the end of their fertile window, had their financial situation been different, had they had more support available to them from family, extended family, etc. Now,
had we not destroyed the world and the climate?
Okay. And this is definitely something that is a really big factor for the younger cohorts of people without children, right? What are the ethics of bringing a child into the world? If I'm turning on the news and I'm seeing that by 2050, which is coming up, I mean, it's not that far off at this point, we're going to be facing kind of like catastrophic climate events on a regular basis. Like, is it even fair to bring a child into the world if that is the prognosis on climate change? And I call that specific cohort childless by climate change. And I don't think these people are taken seriously by demographers and economists who are, you know, really sounding the alarm on imminent population collapse if women or people, but they typically say women, but every child that comes into the world is a result of a male and a female on some level. You know, if people continue to stop having children, then we'll witness what people are calling, referring to as climate collapse, which is hugely scaremongering given that we currently have 8 billion people. And in fact, Gen Alpha is set to be the biggest generation on record. There will be more Gen Alphas than we've ever seen of any other generation. Sure. So as much as it's complicated, because as much as the birth rate is going down, because we've had such huge exponential population growth over the past two centuries, the population is still increasing pretty fast, right? It's just the growth is slowing down. Where and this goes in a slightly different direction, but I'll touch on it. You know, our economy is built on perpetual growth.
Yeah.
But we've had completely unsustainable growth the past two centuries. For example, just 100 years ago, the population of the United States was less than a quarter of what it is now. Just 100 years ago. If we continued growing at that rate, which is what the economy kind of quote unquote needs, we would have a population of just like billions in the US alone. And that's just, it's really, truly not sustainable. You don't have to be a climate specialist to know that we have a the planet has a finite landmass with finite resources, right? So this slowdown is necessary. But there's a lot of scaremongering around it. Sorry, that went into a slightly different, I went off on a bit of a tangent.
No, I love it. Oh, it's all relevant.
To go back to this thing about choices and circumstances, I question in the book rather, where did choices end and circumstances begin? Because actually the circumstances of our birth, the family that we're born into, the culture that we're born into, the religious programming that we might kind of receive as a young person, all of these will inform our choices as a human being, right? The choices that we make will then help to shape our circumstances going forwards, you know? So choices and circumstances are a real gray area. There's a lot of crossover between choices and circumstances. And so I think that there's a lot of crossover between childless by choice, childless by circumstance as well. Because you could also say that infertility is a set of circumstances that determine. Yeah. Yeah. And then back to the climate piece, I mean, there's more and more research that's coming out to show that toxins in the environment are driving a lot of infertility, are really, really, really impacting human fertility. So that's something else that kind of like factors into the whole conversation too. I mean, as you're probably getting, as you and your listener, well, you know, you've read the book, but as your listeners are probably beginning to understand, this is an incredibly complex subject that touches pretty much every area of life.
Well, and that's
our individual lives, but also our lives in terms of the life of humanity. You know, it really is like such a big subject.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why it was so refreshing and enlightening to kind of start thinking about this stuff, prompted by, you know, certain questions that you posed in the book. Like, you actually are getting people to journal and reflect and like look at every single little aspect of their lifestyle, their personality, their upbringing, their family structure, their trauma, history, blah, 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 you know, to really get people to, I guess, try to get more clarity on whether they really do want to be or are cut out to be or have the capacity to be a parent or not. Because I've always thought like it's just absolutely crazy that like, yeah, you know, we have to get a driver's license and this, that and the other. And there's all these regulations around other things, but to have a human and like birth something into the world, there's zero qualifications or training or like prereqs for that. And so people who really should not be having kids are having kids. And, you know, it's so default. It's so expected. It's so, just normalized that, yeah, people don't question. Like, I've never questioned whether I wanted to be a mum or not. And this is like very fresh for me to even be thinking, like, have I always just known I wanted to be a mum? Or was I just conditioned to feel like that? Like, I don't even fucking know anymore. Like, I've always known, or like thought that I've known that I want to be a mom, I want to have kids. But like, I at the same time have always been completely panicked and overwhelmed at the thought of like what that would actually mean and look like. And in reality, like, could I handle that? Like, am I cut out to be a mom? Do I actually want that? I've always thought, oh, it's going to be the biggest adventure in my life. It is literally like the pinnacle of my life as a woman to like have an experience of like being pregnant and giving birth and then bringing up this little being in the world. And it's almost my duty to like try to bring up a child more consciously and intentionally and with more resources than my parents did, because I want to break the cycle and I want to, you know, interrupt that intergenerational trauma that's been passed down and that like fucked me up. So I've kind of been like really, it's something I nerd out on and I think about a lot, is like how, what kind of a parent I'm going to be, how I'm going to bring up a child, blah, blah, blah. But then like the more, like the older I get, the less ready I feel and the less equipped, you know, I feel, because the world is getting harder and harder to be in and to survive in, and I can barely look after myself. So like what would, you know, I'm really questioning it for the first time, because the time pressure thing, that's fun, isn't it? You know, yeah. You start to hit your 30s and you're like, oh, this decision, which might have been able to just organically unfold in its own time, doesn't really have the space to do that, because now I can hear like a biological clock ticking louder and louder and louder. Plus people are clamoring to start, you know, pointing out, you don't have kids yet. Are you going to have kids? Do you not want them? Why? You know, so I think because of that external pressure and then the time pressure, we're kind of forced into making a split decision or jumping on an opportunity. Like, I know so many women who like weren't sure if they wanted to have kids, but then they accidentally got pregnant and now pushing 40. So they're like, fuck, this could be my last chance. I'll just do it. And like that in itself is like so scary, you know, like the amount of people that are falling into parenthood without reflecting or questioning it, and all of the prompts that you kind of, you know, provide in your book, the stories in the podcast, Women Without Kids with the interviews, like all of this is so important to just, I guess, give people like pause to go, oh yeah, that isn't just like something that I have to automatically opt into because it's expected. And I just like didn't even like question that it might be an option for me, you know, oh, I can actually like reflect on some really, it's like, you know, people also just like leap into marriages without like checking if they've got aligned values with their partner about what lifestyle they want to lead, whether they've got financial hygiene in a similar kind of way, whether, you know, they both want to have kids or not. And if they do, how they want to bring those kids up. Like there's so many like communication breakdowns and conversations that are not being had and questions that are not being asked before we make these massively life-changing decisions that affect other fucking people, like these poor kids being born to people, to parents that just don't consciously, you know. And I'm not like blaming and judging, like there's a reason why this is like this, and we're just starting to kind of, yeah, I guess, like work on it now. But
well,
you know,
well, I mean, something I will big... say, I will just jump in and say, I think that like yeah. majority of people existing today have been born to people who didn't really think about it. And most of yeah. us have turned out like, we're probably all a lot more aware of like how fucked up we are. But you know, I think the majority of us have turned out all right. Like here we are, we're making it work, right? And I think, yes, the more we think about it, probably the fewer children we'll have, the more access we have to questioning, is this the right time? Am I the right person? Do I have what it takes? Is this the right co-parent? The fewer children will be born. And I think that's what's been happening, right? I mentioned that people are having fewer and fewer children. And I think that's largely because people now do have the access to the decision-making process that you're yeah. describing. More people are deciding, I don't think it's for me, or I don't think I'm in a financial place to do this. I don't think I'm going to have, I've got the support that I need to do this. I don't know if I can manage this. But also more people are deciding, I can only have one kid, or maybe I can only make it work if I have two at the max, right? So we've already seen the impact of people having access to more decision making around this subject. Mm-hmm. And that's what's causing the shrinking in the birth rate. And I think the more freedom people have to question, is this right for me? The fewer children that people will have. And there is a lot of, there's almost this kind of like, oh, well, that means that eventually people will hardly be having any children at all. Oh, and I can see where that kind of like scaremongering or that kind of doomsdaying comes from. But what I want to say is, what if only a very small percentage of people are supposed to have children? And what if we're only supposed to bring a few select people into the planet? And what if we were able to channel all the resources we have into a fewer, mm-hmm. smaller, select group of people who get to mm-hmm. then be the recipient of more love, more attention, more energy, more money, like more financial resource? What if that were actually a good thing? We have a smaller population that is just better resourced overall. You know, I'm not saying necessarily mm-hmm. that would categorically be better, but I'm just kind of saying let's open up to the possibility that that could be a good thing for humanity, you know?
Hey, baby babes. Sorry to interrupt. I just had to pop my head into the lounge here and mention another virtual lounge that I'd love you to get around. It's the Labia Lounge Facebook group that I've created for listeners of the potty to mingle in. There you'll find extra bits and bobs like freebies, behind the scenes, or discounts for offerings from guests who have been interviewed on the podcast. There'll also be, hopefully, inspiring, thought-provoking conversations and support from a community of labial legends like yourself. My vision for this is that it becomes a really supportive, educational, and hilarious resource for you to have more access to me and a safe space to ask questions you can't ask anywhere else. So head over to links in the show notes or look up the Labia Lounge group in Facebook and I'll see you in there. And now back to the episode.
Totally. I remember like a friend had a 4-year-old and I remember being like, oh, are you going to like try to give him a sibling? Because in my mind, I was like, oh my God, I feel sorry for only children. Like it's good to have siblings. Da, da, da. This was years ago. And he was just like, oh my God, like we are stretched thin as it is. It would be selfish to try to, you know, bring another kid into the equation. Like we want to give every bit of energy and time and resource we can to this one kid and try to do that right. Bringing another one in would just stretch us even more thin. So like, why would we do that? And I was like, oh, that's the first time I've heard anyone like make a conscious decision for really good reasons. I was like, wow, you can't argue with that reasoning. Like that's amazing. Go you guys. Right. 'Cause like something that you kind of touched on earlier, which just does not get talked about enough, but I always think about this and I'm like, how many of you are secretly being like, holy fuck, I wish I didn't have kids. But you know, regretting having kids is a thing. People don't want to admit it because, you know, they're afraid of being judged super harshly and ostracized, which they would be by so many people. But given that it's arguably like the biggest commitment and decision that you can make in your whole life, it makes sense that it wouldn't be for everyone. And some people would, you know, regret it once they discovered what a massive thing it is and that it completely changes their life in like all of these ways that they don't actually like or prevents them from thriving. And, I feel like there was a study, and you'd probably know the stats, was it like 7 to 14% mm-hmm. of parents reported regretting having kids? And that would probably be underreported because like how many of them would just not admit that, you know, because it's very frowned upon to regret having your kids. And once they're born, you're like, well, you know, I was literally chatting with someone yesterday who had a 8-year relationship. They had split up, and then after that relationship had split up, she found out she was pregnant and decided to have it. So while they were breaking up, they were also preparing to co-parent as single parents. And, you know, he was young, did not want kids. And he's like, well, I mean, love him now, of course, like doing my best to be a dad and I've stepped up. But like, if I had the choice, definitely wouldn't have chosen to do that. Like, you know, it's been massive. So, and I think like we have to stop shaming people for that because it's very natural to feel that way.
Very natural. And you said something, and that story illustrates that it is possible to regret having made that decision and to deeply love your children and appreciate and value them as human beings. Those two things are not mutually exclusive. Like it's very normal. Yeah. I think it's very normal to regret, like, oh, wow, yeah, I made this decision and it changed my life in all sorts of ways that I wouldn't choose for myself if I could make that decision again. And hey, welcome to being a human. Here I am living with the decisions I've made and making the best of it. Like, that's most of us actually, about lots of different things. Right. And so, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there is a brilliant book called Regretting Motherhood, which I quote throughout Women Without Kids. It's by an Israeli sociologist, actually, Orna Donat, who did a study with women who said they would happily talk about regretting having children. And I think she interviewed about 25 women. And just some of the interviews are just amazing, like amazing taboo breaking, work, you know, to hear people speak honestly about it and then be able to weigh that in, like factor that in because you could hear all of that. You could know all of this and you could still say, you know what? This is that once in a lifetime, unbeatable, never repeatable adventure. And I'm too curious. I just have to know how it's going to be. And I'm entering into it with full awareness of everything that could go wrong, all of the challenges that it's going to bring my way. And you know what? I still want to do it anyway. How amazing for everyone to enter into parenthood from that place. You know?
I think that's kind of where I'm sitting now. I'm like, yeah, I'm definitely more on the fence than I've ever been. It's never been a question for me. I'm like, I'm going to be a mum, no doubt, no question.
Amazing.
And it's only in recent years that I've been like, actually, like, how much of that is conditioning and how much of that is like an innate kind of desire to be a mum? And, but you know, I watch a birth scene in a movie or even a fucking commercial and I'll cry. Like, I cry every single time I see any kind of birth, like fictional or no. And like, I love, I think through my work as well with like women and pregnancy and things, you know, it's definitely an adventure I want to have because I'm curious. But then I'm like, well, is that just selfish? Like, do I just want to have this great adventure of experiencing pregnancy and birth and having a child? But then actually the having a child bit, like, am I equipped for that?
For someone in this position now, you can go into, you're becoming fully aware of all those challenges, right? So you can really start at the age that you are. And 33 is still pretty young. Like, you've still got a good, infertility is impacting people at younger and younger ages, not least because of those environmental factors that I touched on. So now is the time to really be thinking about it. But it sounds to me like if you embark on this path, you're going to be going into it eyes fully open, knowing what boundaries you might need to put in place, knowing what asks you might need to start making, knowing what decisions you might need to start prioritizing in order to best set yourself up to be the parent that you want to be. And that is, again, a great place to be entering parenthood from, I think.
Yeah, totally. I think
funny you said that about like birthing scenes. When I watch births or where I even like hear pregnancy stories, I recoil and repulsed, in horror a lot of the time.
Totally.
I'm just like, people want that. Oh my God. And I think I've always felt that way. You know, I write in the book about my younger brother. My mom decided to have a home birth. And that's really one of my earliest like childhood memories when I was 3 and a half of remembering my brother being born in our little teeny tiny cottage and how terrifying it was. And I don't know, I could get deep into the psychology of like, did that scar me for life? I don't think it did, because like my brother's arrival into our lives was so joyful. Like, he was a very difficult baby. Like, he was noisy, but he was always just so adorable. And there are all the pictures of my brother and me and my brother when we're kids are of me just like really like, I love him so much. And so I don't think I was scarred by the home birth necessarily, but yeah, I've always just, the whole idea of being pregnant, giving birth has just been absolutely terrifying to me. Yeah. And so I don't know where that came from, apart from it's just an innate thing of who I am. And there are so many women who are just like, just want to like have a deep yearning to experience that. And I think that's amazing and incredible. And they're the ones who should be having kids.
Fully get your side of it too, though. I'm simultaneously in awe and moved and horrified and scared and repulsed. Like, of course, it's fucking, it's hectic. So it's, I totally get
wild.
It.
Yeah.
Get it. I know. My cousin, when she was pregnant, she didn't ever think she was going to have kids and was probably like, nah, kind of don't want them anyway. And then randomly got pregnant kind of accidentally when she was maybe 40 or something. And she hated being pregnant. It was just like, this whole experience is awful. What the fuck? I'm not doing birth. Give me an elective C-section. Get it out the sunroof. She was just like, I'm never doing that again.
Sunroof.
So funny. But something that like, yeah, something that I feel like maybe I'm very not fixated on, but something I think about a lot is this fear of passing down intergenerational patterns, family dysfunction, trauma, you know, despite being quite self-aware, being into personal development, really wanting to work on it, really being very consciously and intentionally and actively trying not to fuck up my kid in the same ways that I was, I'm still like, oh my God, how do I know when I'm exhausted and sleep deprived and, you know, at my wit's end, I'm not just going to fall back into the same patterns as my parents. And, you know, like this quote, from Yemi Penn, who's amazing. I think it's something like, trauma not transformed is trauma transferred. And like, I'm always like, oh my God, like, you know, I'm trying to transform my trauma, but like, there's only so much I can do. And like, you know, I'm not going to have sorted through all of it by the time I have kids, if I have kids. So, you know, and there was a quote I've written down. Where is it? From your book. When in fact, if hurt people hurt people, endlessly projecting our unprocessed pain onto others and thus creating more suffering in the world, then healing our own shit before handing it down for the next generation to fix is as valid a contribution to society as any, a purpose in and of itself. You know, and I think that was within the context of like, oh, but like your only purpose as a woman and your only contribution to society is to procreate and like contribute to the workforce with like more kids and stuff. And you were kind of pointing out like that's such an important and valid purpose to actually just try not to hand down more unprocessed pain. So I just wanted to like insert that because I loved that so much.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that, you know, there's a whole sort of conscious parenting movement underway of people who are really kind of saying, I acknowledge that my trauma will be passed on to my children. It's kind of, if it's in, you know, so much of our trauma is in our DNA. So much of our trauma is inherited from ancestors that we didn't actually consciously know, right? And it's just kind of been passed on blindly down the generations. Like that is going to be passed on to your children. And I think there is a growing awareness that actually a lot of the healing work can be done in relationship with your children, you know? That if you choose the path of conscious parenting, you can acknowledge all my patterns are going to show up in my relationship with my children. With conscious awareness, I can do the work of repairing them in relationship, in the way that I parent my children. And I think that's an incredibly valuable path too. And I think that my mother definitely comes into that conscious parenting category. She came quite late to it. So a lot of the patterns had been really deeply embedded by the time she got to that work. I was around 12, 13 when she got to that sort of work, but have definitely been the beneficiary of that myself. In the book I write about how, you know, I question, I suppose, what is ending with us when we decide not to have children or we're not able to have children. And I think this intergenerational trauma piece is absolutely a part of that, looking to, well, I'm not going to pass this on to another biological child, but how can I work on my own kind of inner child work, reparenting work? Like literally it's even called, it even has these names, right? How can I address that in myself so that my actions in the world, my work in the world, my interactions with other human beings are not going to be replicating those same traumas, right? Which I've inherited as part of my family system.
Another, not a direct quote, but something that popped into my head that I heard, I think it was on Jamila Jamil's podcast, and she was saying, I think she'd heard it as well somewhere, but you know, she was like, well, would you rather get to the end of your life and regret not having kids? Because, you know, that really only affects you. Like if you regret not having kids, then you're sad, but that doesn't affect anyone else. However, you know, or would you rather like having kids and then regretting it because it's affected not only your life, but then also the children that you chose to bring into the world and then their children and possibly even a whole lineage, you know? So that's like, that really hit. I was like, whoa, true.
And I will say that, like, you know, I gave my mum the unedited manuscript of the book before I handed it into my publisher, because I really wanted to make sure that everything I was sharing, there's a lot of stories from my life, but from her life too, and some of her family background stuff. I just wanted to make sure she was okay with everything I was putting in the book. Yeah. And it turned out to be probably one of the most healing processes of my life, like having the very difficult conversations that came up as a result of that between she and I. And it made me realize that, like, wow, you can have four people in the same family having a completely different experience of that family. It's fascinating. Fascinating at the time. It's very painful. But during the process, I remember she said to me at one point, she was like, are you happy that I had you? Because I think she had really got the sense that I felt, you know, that I'd been I was very aware of the damage. I was very aware of, like, the deep, like, there's deep levels of dysfunction in my family, as there are in so many families. And I think she had really felt that, like, was it okay? Was it okay of me to even bring you into this shit show? And I was like, hell yes. Thank you. Like, I'm so grateful for this life. Like, yes, there's been all this hard, horrible stuff. And yes, I'm still so glad that I'm here. Some days I don't feel like that. Some days it does feel like, God, this is hard. Life is damn hard. It's tax season here in the moment in the UK. Oh, in the US rather. And let alone just deep, deep despair over how my taxes are spent in this country. But just I was in a deli, and it's this really bougie deli in Brooklyn where I live. And this homeless guy had come in, and everyone's kind of like backing off and avoiding him. But he has a fistful of dollars, and he's looking for something. He's wanting to buy some food, right? And he's looking at stuff, and it's like $5 for a soda, or like $5. And he ends up buying a banana. And like, he went outside. He was obviously quite erratic, like, and he sat there and he's eating his banana and he was kind of yelling. And I was just like, fuck. It's such like having a life in this world that we have created with such deep inequality, where it's so fucking hard just to like pay the fucking rent. That's a huge responsibility to put onto another human being. And I really felt it in that moment of just like, fuck, how selfish to bring a human into the world because you think it's going to make you happy, and then go, there you go. Here's what rent is, by the way. Here's what it takes to have a job, by the way. Here's what it takes to feed yourself, by the way. It's a fucking huge responsibility, you know? And so, yeah, I can get quite existential about it as well. And quite misanthropic. Like, this book, writing this book really made me touch closely, deeply with some of the worst parts of humanity, you know? And I'm still glad I was born. And let's take that pain. Let's take that and say, well, how can we not fix this? And I'm not a believer in fixes, but how can we try as a humanity to like make it a bit better, a bit easier for the new generations who are being born? How can we like shoulder some of that responsibility ourselves and actually try to do something to make this world? Because, you know, going back to, and again, I don't want to romanticize like past times necessarily, but there was a time when human beings lived in tribes, lived off the land, you know, lived in community. It just, there were challenges, of course. But the challenges weren't the kind of intractable, like man-made, deeply unfair and deeply fixable challenges that make it so hard to find a partner, set up a good home, decide to bring children. So many of the things that making it really hard to decide to bring children into the world are actually fixable. They're man-made problems. Yeah. We could come up with
patriarchal problems.
They're patriarchal, capitalistic, extractive, industrialized problems, right? Like, so many of these problems are solvable. And it's just so messed up. that we can't seem to figure it out.
It's so hard not to get super existential. This is like really a constant cycle of like.
Believe me, I was writing this book with COVID raging, and it was, and Black Lives Matter, and it was all just there. I was like,
oh my god, how many mental bees did you have in
that? What is going on with humanity?
Oh, far out. Oh, okay. So I've still got a few, like, you know, hard hitting questions for you, and I'm conscious of time. I want to quickly try to slot in the segment Get Pregnant and Die.
Don't have sex, because you will get pregnant and die. Don't have sex in the missionary position. Don't have sex standing up. Just don't do it, promise.
Do you have a story about your sex education that you want to share with us? Maybe how it failed you, maybe something that was great about it. Joke.
Yeah, I mean, I write about this in Women Without Kids. There's a chapter called Sexual Evolution. And I open that chapter by talking about how limiting sex ed is when it comes to female sexuality. I mean, honestly, what I learned was that female sexuality is for procreation.
Yeah.
It almost felt like the female orgasm, for example, was just this superfluous, like, phenomenon that we didn't really need to learn anything about, that didn't really have a purpose.
Yep.
Don't need to talk about that. For men, of course, ejaculation is necessary for the furthering of the species. So boys and orgasms and masturbation, that all kind of goes together. But women and orgasms and pleasure, sexual pleasure, just seem to have no place in the conversation. And that, I mean, you could on the one hand look at that as quite sort of surface level in a way, but it's not. It's really deeply not. Like, I've been thinking a lot, and this is one of the reasons I was exciting to speak to you, actually, because I haven't found another place to talk about this. About the concept of orgasmic entitlement. Okay. If you think about the sensation of an orgasm, this is a sensation of wholeness, satisfaction, fulfillment, a deep sense of just like coming home to oneself, belonging. Yeah. And to tell women, you don't need, you don't have to worry about any of that. None of that's important. None of that's necessary. I just think it has such deep roots in terms of gender inequality.
Yeah.
Sorry, obviously makes me really emotional, but like boys and men learn from as early as they become connected to their sexuality that a sense of fulfillment, a sense of deep satisfaction is their birthright. It's something that is necessary for them. Women are not taught that. And I just think the repercussions of that are fucking huge.
Yeah. Oh my God. I've got goosebumps. You're talking to the right person. Because, I mean, it's not even that it's their birthright. They're also...
Failed me. That is how sex education failed me.
Yes. Oh, enormous, you know, and they're taught that not only is that, like, you know, feeling of wholeness and connection and pleasure their birthright, but they are entitled to it and they're entitled to take it from us.
Orgasmic entitlement. Yes, exactly. Yeah,
like, oh, and the fact that, you know, like I talk about this a fair bit, you know, the feeling of assertiveness, the boost in testosterone that comes from orgasm, the sexual sovereignty, the self-love and self-connection, that feeling of wholeness, everything you just described, all of that that is accessible through female orgasm, it creates women who are harder to control and who are going to speak up more and who are a little bit more headstrong and, like, grounded in it. So, you know, the patriarchal kind of structures in place cottoned onto that and were like, oh, well, you know, and Naomi Wolf does a beautiful job of kind of laying out all the examples of where this knowledge has been weaponized by the patriarchy, has been used in wars where the soldiers are instructed to go in and shove bayonets in the vaginas of all of the women of the tribe or the, you know, the community. it, you know, rape is part of the rape and pillage part is definitely aimed at cutting that entire kind of, culture down at the, you know, where it really hurts the most, because they know what a huge impact that has on the women. It's just, yeah, it's horrific. I can't even, oh my God, the big topic. But yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's so important to recognize that. And I don't think many people think about it. And it's kind of like with all of this stuff, it's like the water we're swimming in. We've all been born into this, you know, this kind of environment where like we don't even, like I love, you know, when you talk about the patriarchal institution of motherhood and the mummy binary, that's such a good, and maybe you can kind of touch on that. That's such a good way of illuminating certain factors that like maybe people don't naturally reflect on or think about. Cause it's just been basically like baseline, like that's so, normalized and insidious, you know, like I haven't thought about that until more recent years.
Excuse this quick interruption. I'm shamelessly seeking reviews and 5-star ratings for the potty because, as I'm sure you've noticed by now, it's pretty fab. And the more people who get to hear it, the more people I can help with it. Reviews and ratings actually do make a big difference to this little independent podcaster. And it's really easy to just quickly show your support by taking that simple act of either leaving 5 stars for the show on Spotify, or even better, writing a written review and leaving 5 stars over on Apple Podcasts. Or if you're a real overachiever, you can do them both. That would be mad. If you're writing a review, though, just be sure to use G-rated words, because despite the fact that this is a podcast about sexuality, words like sex can be censored and your review won't make it through the gates. Lame. Anyway, I would personally recommend doing that right now while you remember, just to get on top of it and let me know you're with me on this journey. Thanks, gang. Enjoy the rest of the epi.
Right. I mean, in terms of the orgasmic entitlement, just to go back to that quickly, the reason it's relevant to the women without kids conversation is because of what I touched on, the fact that female orgasm isn't necessary for procreation. And so therefore, if we perceive female sexuality as being for procreation, we don't need to worry about women experiencing sexual pleasure or sexual fulfillment, right? The fulfillment is the baby. And that, again, is where that kind of like, you will only be fulfilled when you have a baby. But what about having amazing orgasms every day? Maybe I'll be a lot less worried about, you know, needing to buy all this shit to make me feel good. Like, you know, totally. Like, seriously, I think there's so much in that. And I'm happy to have a space to talk about it. And I hope that we start talking about it more because I think it's a huge missing piece, you know?
Oh, big time. So one other thing that it was a concept I was introduced to a few years ago. Can't remember where. And it's gaining a little bit of, I wouldn't say popularity, but like it's something people are more aware of, is that, you know, to tap into your, fertility, creativity, you know, this birthing, gestating kind of, vibe. It's a terrible way of putting that. You don't need to have a baby, you know, like we can leave a legacy. I mean, what is the obsession with leaving a legacy? What even, you know,
totally.
We can do that, and we can create and produce and gestate ideas and birth creative projects. And there are other ways, you know. I've got a friend who's just turned 40. She's kind of, really come to the conclusion. I don't actually want kids. I don't feel the need to do that. Her business is her baby. Her business is where she births all of her kind of creative projects and ideas. And she, So I'd love to chat about, cause I know that's something that you touch on as well, is like, you can leave a legacy in other ways than popping out a kid.
Yeah. Well, the legacy piece, it's such a patriarchal, it literally has its roots in patriarchy. Legacy is literally about the material inheritance that we pass on to the next generation to ensure the kind of like, immortality of our own genetic kind of imprint, I suppose. Hence why children are supposed to take their father's name, because it's all about the father carrying on his legacy in the world and his sort of genes and his family and the, you know, but I mean, literally from an existential place as well, like material inheritance being literally my physical, my physicality will be continued in my children. I will never die. I mean, it stems from this fear of death. And when I think about legacy, like I don't know, I've just weirdly always been quite accepting of like, yep, I'm here for a blip and then I'm gone and that's that. And I'm okay with that. Like, I don't see.
Who cares?
Does he need to live forever? Yeah. But anyway, yes, the last chapter is called An Other Legacy. And it thinks about like other ways that we can leave a quote unquote legacy. And I mean, I do think that in whatever ways we're able to bring our creativity forth, you know, for some of us, that's in our work. For others, that will be in other ways. I think that anything that we create, and specifically anything that we create that has some kind of an impact on other human beings, is a legacy of sorts, you know? Literally, you and I doing this podcast, we have no idea how many people are going to listen to this, how it might impact their lives, how it might impact their choices, the conversations that they're having with their friends. Like all of that is legacy in a way, you know? Yeah. All of it is about what's our contribution? You know, what's our contribution? Children are one contribution of many that a person can make. Within that, I do want to say, obviously, having a child and being a parent is a very specific job and a very specific experience. There's nothing that can kind of replicate the specificity of that experience in terms of the other creative endeavors and the other things we might do or make with our lives. But I think that, again, like this comes back to the kind of feminist piece in a way, because it's really only in the past century and I was going to say a majority of women, but obviously this isn't speaking for all women globally. But in the cultures where you and I exist, and probably a lot of the people listening, it's only really in the past 50, 60 years that women have had equal opportunities in terms of pursuing other avenues with their lives to motherhood, or very kind of specific kind of female focused professions. Teaching, nursing, essentially care work, you know, have been the only real options for women. So there haven't really been options for women to explore fulfilling career paths in the way that we think of those, you know, in the way that we're talking about careers that do, where we do potentially get to use our creative gifts, where we do get to make a difference on a kind of like in the public life, not just in the private sort of like home sphere. So this again is a really new development. And I think the idea that, going back to the beginning of our conversation, what if you regret not having kids, speaks to this idea that there will come a point when you're looking back at your life and you haven't been fulfilled, you know? And I think that negates the fact that there are now so many ways that we can be fulfilled and so much freedom when it comes to deciding how we want to live our lives, you know?
Totally. There's so many ways to create meaning and purpose that don't require having a kid to give you that purpose or to fill a hole or a void in your life. And I think like for those who just know that that's their purpose, like beautiful, like what an incredible role in your life, in the world to play. But I mean, I used to think of like, and this is just like shows the strength of the conditioning. I used to feel really sad when I'd meet a woman and she'd say she didn't want to have kids or she hadn't had them. And I would always assume, oh, she didn't have them because she mustn't be able to. I couldn't fathom that someone would make the decision not to have them. I was like, what's wrong with you? Something's missing. There's some, you know, which is obviously like you talk about this fear of feeling like there's something wrong with you or something biologically, you know, different that you don't have that, like, that bone in your body that makes you want to become a mom. And I actually used to feel like that. I was like, oh, that's so sad. They're going to regret it. They're going to just feel like they've got this empty, meaningless life. Like, what are they going to do with their time? They're going to hit a certain age and just, you know, like, I'm just like, what? My life's so full. I cannot fathom having a freaking kid in it. Like, I don't know what I was thinking, but that just goes to show how strong that
That's the conditioning. That's the conditioning that's kind of playing on a loop in your head. Going back to like your, you know, the yearnings that you've had, or the joy, that potential joy that you feel about potentially having a children, that didn't sound so much like conditioning to me as what you were just describing, those judgments.
Yeah. And it's interesting to now start to try to pull it apart and be like, what is the programming and conditioning? Right. What is actually my true desire? Yes. Yeah. And, you know, like, do I, and even with that intrinsic desire to have a kid and become a mum, does that still outweigh all of the, my rational kind of reasoning of like, oh, but it's a really like fucked time to bring a kid into the world. I'm not financially stable. I don't have enough. Like, I would never, ever, even though I, you know, if I desperately wanted kids, I wouldn't just do that for my reasons if I didn't have, you know, financial stability, relationship stability, everything kind of, all my ducks in a row. And this is kind of like something that, that I feel like you'll have something to say about this, but I hear this sort of thing all the time, coming from parents generally who seem to just deliver this little gem of unsolicited advice very sagely, as though they're the authority on it. Actually, I think it's like with drinking, like people that drink, when you stop drinking, they want to drag you down with them and they feel really uncomfortable that you're not drinking because that's highlighting the fact that they're, you know, so I feel like people want to peer pressure you into like dragging them down into where they are. But when I say I don't really feel ready to have kids, like if people are questioning, I'm like, oh, I don't feel anywhere near ready to have kids. Like, are you kidding me? And they say, oh, but you're never going to feel ready, but you just make it work. You know, you basically should, it's basically like, oh yeah, you should just like go for it, you know, within the expected time frame that you're supposed to fucking have kids. And then you'll just have to step up when the time comes and you'll surprise yourself and, you know, it'll all be fine and everyone fucks up their kids anyway. So, you know, just, you know, that common joke about like, oh, just start putting away some money into a savings account to pay for their therapy when they're grown up, you know?
Oh, I haven't heard that one before, but oh my God. Okay.
I've heard that quite a few times. Yeah. And I'm like, wow, that seems like really bad advice. Like, that is a crock of shit. Like, are you kidding? Sure. Maybe you never feel fully ready, or you do feel ready, but you, of course you can't be. You don't know what it's actually going to take to be a parent or what kind of fucking kid you're going to have. But I'm like, okay, fuck off out of my face with that, because I'm telling you I don't feel ready and I'm definitely the authority on whether I'm ready or not, because I know what's going on in my head and my life. Don't peer pressure me into having kids. Like, because, oh, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. No, I mean, I do. I speak to that specifically in the book. I think there is an element of truth in, yes, this is a life experience that you can't really predict. Yeah. How it's going to impact you, like you say, not least because you don't know what kind of kid you're going to get, right?
Yeah.
And I think there are some things you just can't fathom until you actually experience them.
Yeah, totally.
But I mean, I know so many people who have felt so ready to have a kid, so ready that they will spend tens of thousands of dollars doing IVF because they're that ready. Yeah. They need to do it. Yeah. They've got to do it. This is the time. And so, yeah, I think again, that's very old. It's kind of like there are so, when you start looking for them or you start listening out for them, there are so many things that people say kind of just on repeat. It's almost like the conditioning that gets passed down unconsciously and we just kind of act it out without really realizing we're doing it. There are phrases and sayings that are similar. And this is one of them. Like, nobody ever feels ready. Yes. First of all, lots of people do feel ready. And actually, now that I have the choice and the agency, I can try and get ready. And if that doesn't happen in the time frame, then so be it, you know, because there are other things I can do with my life. It's just very, very old-fashioned thinking that is born from a time period when people just didn't have the choices or the information that they have now. I mean, the thing about like the saving up for your kids therapy, I don't know, in a way it's kind of hilarious, because I do think that the most ready parents who are doing everything right, people life is still going to happen to people and they're probably still going to need therapy.
Yeah, life is going to fuck them up. Like, you don't,
life is going to fuck them up. Like, let alone not knowing like what you're kind of how it's going to be. Like, you don't, the world that they're living in, you don't know who they're going to meet. You don't know what their situation at school is going to be like. You don't know what's going to happen to them. Like, you can't safeguard against all of that. And I think that, yes, if we tried to do that, none of us would ever do anything, right? So there is an element of risk taking in any big life decision that we make, because we can't possibly always know all the outcomes or safeguard for all the outcomes. But this is one of those life choices that does impact another human being. And not only that, but also impacts the society that we're living in and the world that we're living in. So yeah, I think erring on the side of caution in this area is probably the best bet for everybody involved.
I think it's smart. I think it's a smart way to go. Don't have a band-aid baby to save your relationship or to fill a void in your life. Like, maybe get some therapy and some hobbies and see where you're
and
at.
And then also, you know, I also have quite a strong kind of spiritual bent, let's say. Yeah. And I do think that, like, everybody has karma, right? And it's some people's karma to be, and this is going to sound a bit harsh, it's some people's karma to be born into kind of a fucked up situation, have those life lessons be part of their life path, you know? Mm-hmm. And again, I think that I see part of my work as a creator as offering tools and offering support to people who are grappling with these really difficult life decisions. Cause I've grappled with them myself. My parents have both grappled with this stuff, and it's like part of my karma, I suppose, having been born into a deeply dysfunctional family has been about grappling with that dysfunction and making something out of it.
Totally. Yeah. And, you know, something I want to make sure I kind of highlight or leave people with is, like, obviously we get quite heavily less and less, but, you know, heavily judged or criticized, and even in insidious kind of subtle ways where, like, there seems to be this, I don't know, belief that if you haven't gone through this initiation of becoming a mum, you are less developed or less whole or less mature. Don't really have that with dads though, do we? Mm-hmm. And I just think, like, if you can throw that in the bin, cause like it actually serves the world so much better for there to be, you know, some child-free people who have the energy and the time and the, you know, capacity to support others that are in the parenting role, or to be the cool auntie, or to be in roles. I mean, that frees up women to be in roles of, like, in corporate roles, politics, positions of power, policy making. I mean, it's definitely doing a community service in a different way to, like, decide not to have kids and to dedicate your life to other pursuits as well, you know? So yeah, I guess, like, if there's anything that you would want to leave people with or emphasize, or even maybe some, you know, some questions for people to reflect on, say they are on the fence about whether to have, you know, kids, what would you love to say to people?
Well, I suppose just something that was coming up as you were talking there. Like, I've thought a lot about if humanity had sort of been left to its natural devices and we hadn't had all of the technological and industrial and medical interventions that we had, I think we'd actually find that it was quite natural for not everybody to have children, you know? Yep. And that any society does benefit from having adult humans who are not caught up in the daily rearing of children, right? I think that that's, and so I suppose something to, I guess I'd maybe just like to leave people with that as a reflection. What if it was natural and normal was for not everybody to have kids? And actually only the people who really felt a very strong calling to that vocation to pursue that path. What would our society look like then? What would our individual lives look like then? Who would we expect to have children? And what expectations would we have for, you know, other adults in society? And it's just really interesting stuff to reflect on as we are. It's such a, like, it feels like we're at a real kind of crucial turning point. I don't know that, you know, I think most generations think this on some level, like we're at a turning point for humanity. But I do think that with the new technologies that are coming in and all the conversations around AI and industrialization, et cetera, and globalization, I do think we're at quite a kind of evolutionary crunch point. And I think that this shift in terms of demographics, like in terms of the drop off in the birth rate and fewer people having children, is a part of that. And I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's maybe part of the big grand plan. And so what if we started looking at it that way, you know? I think it's an interesting place maybe to close and to leave people.
Yeah, beautiful. I love that. So you didn't think you got off without a TMI, did you? I've just remembered. TMI, we love it. TMI, we love it. So we'll just squeeze it right in at the end. If you can't remember anything, that's fine. But has the conversation sparked any ideas of what, and it doesn't have to be like sex related, or, you know, it can be something funny. It can be something vulnerable. It can just, yeah, I mean, been... TMI is literally the sort of stuff that people find too taboo to talk about. And I feel like you deal in talking about stigmatized taboo things, right?
I mean, so I share lots of stuff in my books. I suppose something I have been, I do love talking about periods, which is, I don't know, it's feeling less and less taboo, but, and probably not at all taboo for you. But one thing that's fascinating to me is I, you know, I'm 48. I don't even believe that I'm perimenopausal. And my period, because I had anorexia in my teens, as a result of a relationship that I was in, very, very abusive relationship, which I do write about in the book. I actually, and something I didn't put in the book, because not because it was TMI, it just, there just wasn't really space. It kind of interrupted the flow. It was a whole other tangent. I actually believe that on some level, I developed an eating disorder to shut my reproductive system down so that I wouldn't get pregnant with that person. That is like just something that I believe about my body. But anyway, all of which is to say my period has been irregular off like ever since then. It was always, it was always very long, patchy, never really knew when it was coming. It was kind of all over the place. And that was massively annoying because it just, you know, it's just annoying. Anyway, my period completely regulated as soon as I started working on this book. Since summer 2020, when I started working on the proposal for this book, my period has come between every 26 and 29 days without fail. And I'm 48. I'm like, to me is just like, but it just, to me, again, going back to that sort of more mystical, spiritual side of myself, I truly believe that writing this book and really getting clarity around not only my decision not to have children, my family history, where we're at in terms of our society, my place in the history of womankind has sort of just, I don't know, I just feel like on a biological, spiritual level, something's just clicked into place. And I'm so grateful now that I have regular periods because I can plan my life around my cycle, which I've, it's a game changer.
Totally. You know? Oh, it's so good when it's predictable. Hey, it's,
oh my God,
having super erratic periods. You just would never know when it was going to
you. Never know when it's PMS. You never know. Like you just can't, I don't know. But now I can really plan around my cycle and that's so empowering, you know? So, so that's the kind of, because I think some people think periods are TMI, probably not your listeners, but I'm fascinated with cycles, periods, like all of that stuff.
Oh, I love that. No, that was a perfect story. That's so interesting. I mean, it also doesn't surprise me. Like it makes sense that obviously that book writing process was so healing and so empowering.
Well, I think the writing of the book, but then the conversations that I had with my mother in particular about the contents of the book and the conversations that we had about the other mothers and the women in our shared lineage. Like, I just feel like giving a voice to all those stories, even if just for myself, has just settled something in my being. That's just such a gift.
I've got goosebumps. That's amazing. Wow. Oh, thank you so much, Ruby, for being so generous with your time. I know we've gone a little bit over. And just so much, thought-provoking wisdom. I'll put links to your website and books and everything in the show notes. Is there anything else you wanted to just plug or say?
I'm kind of annoyed that I had, that I kind of like got all emotional talking about orgasmic entitlement because I was hoping you'd use that as an audio clip to promote the episode, but now I hope you don't. Anyway, maybe you can find a bit where I'm not like breaking down about how unfair it is that men get to have orgasms.
Hey, me again. If you'd like to support the potty and you've already given it 5 stars on whatever platform you're listening on, I want to mention that you can buy some really dope merch from the website and get yourself a Labia Lounge tote, tee, togs. Yep, you heard that right. I even have Labia Lounge bathers. Or a cute fanny pack if that'd blow your hair back. So if fashion isn't your passion, though, you can donate to my Buy Me a Coffee donation page, which is actually called Buy Me a Soy Chai Latte, because I'll be the first to admit, I'm a bit of a Melbourne cafe tosser like that. And yes, that is my coffee order. You can do a once-off donation or an ongoing membership and sponsor me for as little as 3 fat ones a month. And I also offer one-on-one coaching and online courses that'll help you level up your sex life and relationship with yourself and others in a really big way. So every bit helps because it ain't cheap to put out a sweet podcast into the world every week out of my own pocket. So I will be undyingly grateful if you support me and my biz financially in any of these ways. And if you like, I'll even give you a mental BJ with my mind from the lounge itself. Saucy. And I'll pop the links in the show notes. Thank you. Later.
No, I do have, there's going to be an in-person Women Without Kids retreat. Now it's happening in Massachusetts at the end of September with Rachel Cargill, who runs the child-free account. We are, she runs the account Rich Auntie Supreme, but there is going to be an online option so that people can also join via live stream from all around the world. Right. So I'll share the link to that with you as well. That's going to be a weekend long retreat, getting really deeply into this questioning process that we've been discussing. Is this right for me? Isn't this right for me? You know, what are my options? What are my choices? What does it mean to be a woman without kids?
Yeah, amazing. Oh, I've been following Rich Auntie Supreme for ages. I think she's so great. So that's an amazing pairing.
Yes.
Beautiful. All right. Everyone check that out. Follow Ruby's work. Read the book. Yeah. Thank you so much, Ruby.
Well, thanks again for having me. It's lovely to meet you.
And that's it, darling hearts. Thank you for stopping by the Labia Lounge. Your bum groove in the couch will be right where you left it, just waiting for you to sink back in for some more double L action next time. And in the meantime, if you'd be a dear and subscribe, share this episode, or leave a review on iTunes, then you can pat yourself on the snatch, because that, my dear, is a downright act of sex-positive feminist activism. And you'd be supporting my vision to educate, empower, demystify, and destigmatize with this here podcast. Also, I'm always open to feedback, topic ideas that you'd love to hear covered, or guest suggestions. So feel free to get in touch via my website at freyagraph.com or say hey over on Insta. My handle is freya_graph_ymt, and I seriously hope you're following me on there, because damn, we have fun. We have fun. Anyway, later, labial legends. I'll see you next time.